John Woodford, in his first moments of returning consciousness, was not aware that he was lying in his coffin. He had only a dull knowledge that he lay in utter darkness and that there was a close, heavy quality in the air he breathed. He felt very weak and had only a dim curiosity as to where he was and how he had come there. He knew that he was not lying in his bedroom at home, for the darkness there was never so complete as this. Home? That memory brought others to John Woodford's dulled brain, and he recalled his wife now and his son. He remembered, too, that he had been very ill at home, very ill, and that was all that he could remember. What was this place to which he had been brought? Why was the darkness so complete and the silence so unbroken? And why was there no one near him? He was a sick man, and they should have given him better care than this. He lay with a dull irritation at this treatment growing in his mind. Then he became aware that breathing was beginning to hurt his lungs, that the air seemed warm and foul. Why didn't someone open a window? His irritation grew to such a point that it spurred his muscles into action. He put out his right hand to reach for a bell or a light button. His hand moved slowly only a few inches to the side, and then was stopped by an unyielding barrier. His fingers feebly examined it. It seemed a solid wall of wood or metal, faced with smooth satin. It extended all along his right side, and when he weakly moved his other arm, he found a similar wall on that side, too. His irritation gave way to mystification. Why in the world had they put him, a sick man, into this narrow place? Why his shoulders rubbed against the sides on either side? He would soon know the reason for it, he told himself. He raised up to give utterance to a call that would bring those in attendance on him. To his utter amazement, his head bumped against a similar silk-lined wall directly above his face. He raised his arms in the darkness and discovered with growing astonishment that this wall or ceiling extended above him from head to foot, like those on either side. He lay upon a similar silk-padded surface. Why in the name of all that was holy had they put him into a silk-lined box like this? Woodford's brain was puzzling this when a minor irritation made itself felt. His collar was hurting him. It was a high, stiff collar, and it was pressing into the flesh of his neck. But this again was a mystery, that he should be wearing a stiff collar. Why had they dressed a sick man in formal clothes and put him into this box? Suddenly, John Woodford shrieked, and the echoes of his scream reverberated around his ears like hideous demonic laughter. He suddenly knew the answer to it all. He was not a sick man anymore at all. He was a dead man. Or at least they had thought him dead and had put him into this coffin and closed it down. He was buried alive. The fears of his lifetime had come true. His secret dark forebodings were hideously realized. From earliest childhood, he had feared this very horror, for he had known himself subject to cataleptic sleeps, hardly to be distinguished from death. He had had nightmares of premature burial. Even after the proneness to the cataleptic condition seemed to have left him, his fears had clung to him. He had never told his wife or son of his fears, but they had persisted. They had inspired him to exact a promise that he would not be embalmed when buried, and would be interred in this private vault instead of in the earth. He had thought that in case he were not really dead, these provisions might save his life, but now he realized that they only laid him open to the horrible fate he had dreaded. He knew with terrible certainty that he now lay in his coffin in the stone vault in the quiet cemetery. His screams could not be heard outside the vault, probably not even outside the coffin. As long as he had lain in cataleptic sleep, he had not breathed, but now that he was awake and breathing, the air in the coffin was rapidly being exhausted, and he was doomed to perish of suffocation. John Woodford went temporarily mad. He screamed with fear-choked throat, and as he shrieked, he clawed with hands and feet at the unyielding satin-covered surfaces around and above him. He beat upward as best as he could upon the coffin's lid with his clenched fists, but the heavy fastenings held firm. He yelled until his throat was too swollen to give utterance to further sound. He clawed at the top until he broke his nails against the metal behind the silk padding. He raised his head and beat against the top with it until he fell back half-stunned. He lay exhausted for moments, unable to make further efforts. In his brain marched a hideous pageant of horrors. The air seemed much closer and hotter now, seemed to burn his lungs with each breath he inhaled. With a sudden return of his frenzy, he shrieked and shrieked again. This would not do. He was in a horrible situation, but he must do the best he could not to give way to the horror. He had not many minutes left, and he must use them in the most rational way possible to try to escape his terrible prison. With this resolution, a little calm came to him, and he began to test his powers of movement. He clenched his fists again and hammered upward, but this did no good. His arms were jammed so close against his body by the coffin's narrowness that he could not strike a strong blow, nor had he any leverage to push strongly upward. What about his feet? Feverishly, he tried them, but found his kicks upward even less powerful. He thought of hunching up his knees and thus bursting up the lid, but found that he could not raise his knees high enough, and that when he pressed upward with them against the lid, his feet simply slid away on the smooth silk of the coffin's bottom. Now the breaths he drew seared his lungs and nostrils, and his brain seemed to be on fire. He knew his strength was waning, and that before long he would lose consciousness. He must do whatever he could swiftly. He felt the soft silk about him, and the dreadful irony of it came home to him. He had been placed so lovingly in this death trap. He tried to turn on his side, for he thought now that he might use his shoulders to heave up against the lid. But turning was not easy in the cramped coffin, and had to be accomplished by a myriad little hitching movements, an infinitely slow and painful process. John Woodford hitched and squirmed desperately until he lay on his left side. He found then that his right shoulder touched the lid above. He braced his left shoulder on the coffin's bottom and heaved upward with all his strength. There was no result. The lid seemed as immovable as ever. He heaved again, despair fast filling his heart. He knew that very soon he would give way and shriek and claw. There was already a ringing in his ears. He had not many minutes left. With the utter frenzy of despair, he heaved upward again with his shoulder. This time there was a grating sound of something giving above. The sound was like the wild peal of thousands of bells of hope to John Woodford's ears. He heaved quickly again and again at the lid. Paying no attention to the bruising of his shoulder, he pressed upward with every ounce of his strength. There was another grating sound, then a snap of metal fastenings breaking, and as he shoved upward with convulsive effort, the heavy metal lid swung up and over and struck the stone wall with a deep clang. A flood of cold air struck him. He struggled up over the coffin's side, dropped a few feet to a stone floor, and lay in a huddled mass. It was minutes before he had mastered himself and summoned enough strength to stand up. He stood inside a little vault that held no coffin but his own. Its interior was in darkness, save for a dim shaft of starlight that came through a tiny window high up in one wall. John Woodford stumbled to the vault's heavy iron doors and fumbled at their lock. He had an uncontrollable horror of this place that had almost been the scene of his perishing. The coffin there on the shelf, with its lid leaning against the stone wall, seemed gaping for him with its dark, cavernous mouth. He worked frantically at the lock. What if he was not able to escape from the vault? But the heavy lock was easily manipulated on the inside, he found. He managed to turn its tumbler and shoot its bar, and then the heavy iron door swung open. John Woodford stepped eagerly out into the night. He stopped on the vault's threshold, closing the doors behind him and then looking forth with inexpressible emotions. The cemetery lay in the starlight before him as a dim, ghostly city of looming monuments and vaults. Little sheets of ice glinted here and there in the dim light, and the air was biting in its cold. Outside, the cemetery's low wall blinked the lights of the surrounding city. Woodford started eagerly across the cemetery, unheeding of the cold. Somewhere across the lights of the city was his home, his wife, and somewhere his son, thinking him dead, mourning him. How glad they would be when he came back to them alive. His heart expanded as he pictured their amazement and their joy at his return. He came to the low stone wall of the cemetery and clambered quickly over it. It was apparently well after midnight, for the cars and pedestrians in sight in this suburban section were few. Woodford hurried along the street. He passed people who looked at him in surprise, and only after some time did he realize the oddness of his appearance. A middle-aged man clad in a formal suit and lacking hat and overcoat was an odd person to meet on a suburban street on a winter midnight. But he paid small attention to their stares. He did turn up the collar of his frock coat to keep out the cold, but he hardly felt the frigid air and the emotions that filled him. He wanted to get home, to get back to Helen, to witness her stupefaction and dawning joy when she saw him return from the dead, living. A streetcar came clanging along, and John Woodford stepped quickly out to board it, but almost as quickly stepped back. He had mechanically thrust his hand into his pocket and found it quite empty. That was to be expected, of course. They didn't put money in a dead man's clothes. No matter, he would soon be there on foot. As he reached the section in which his home was located, he glanced in a store window in passing and saw on a tear sheet calendar a big black date that made him gasp. It was a date 10 days later than the one he last remembered. He had been buried in the vault for more than a week. More than a week in that coffin. It seemed incredible, terrible. But that did not matter now, he told himself. It would only make the joy of his wife and son the greater when they found he was alive. To Woodford himself, it seemed as though he were returning from a journey rather than from the dead. Returned from the dead. As he hastened along the tree-bordered street on which his home was located, he almost laughed aloud as he thought of how amazed some of his friends would be when they met him. They would think him a ghost or a walking corpse, would perhaps shrink in terror from him at first. But that thought brought another. He must not walk in on Helen too abruptly. The husband she had buried 10 days ago must not appear too suddenly, or the shock might easily kill her. He must contrive somehow to soften the shock of his appearance, must make sure that he did not startle her too much. With this resolve in mind, when he reached his big house, set well back from the street, Woodford turned aside through the grounds instead of approaching the front entrance. He saw windows lighted in the library of the house and went toward them. He would see who was there, would try to break the news of his return gently to Helen. He silently climbed onto the terrace outside the library windows and approached the tall easements. He peered in. Through the silken curtains inside, he could clearly see the room's soft-lit interior, cozy with the shelves of his books and with the lamps and fireplace. Helen, his wife, sat on a sofa with her back partly toward the window. Beside her sat a man that Woodford recognized as one of his closest friends, Curtis Dawes. The sight of Dawes gave Woodford an idea. He would get Dawes outside in some way and have him break the news of his return to Helen. His heart was pounding at the sight of his wife. Then Curtis Dawes spoke, his words dimly audible to Woodford outside the window. "Happy, Helen?" he was asking. "So happy, dear," she answered, turning toward him. Out in the darkness, Woodford stared in perplexed wonder. How could she be happy when she thought her husband dead and buried? He heard Curtis Dawes speaking again. "It was a long time," the man was saying. "Those years that I waited, Helen." She laid her hand tenderly on his. "I know, and you never said a word. I respected so your loyalty to John." She looked into the fire musingly. "John was a good husband, Kurt. He really loved me, and I never let him guess that I didn't love him, that it was you, his friend, that I loved. But when he died, I couldn't feel grief. I felt regret for his sake, of course. But underneath it was the consciousness that at last you and I were free to love each other." Dawes's arm went tenderly around her shoulder. "Darling, you don't regret that I talked you into marrying me right away? You don't care that people may be talking about us?" "I don't care for anything but you," she told him. "John was dead. Young Jack has his own home and wife, and there was no reason in the world why we should not marry. I'm glad that we did." In the darkness outside the window, a stunned, dazed John Woodford saw her lift an illuminated face toward the man's. "I'm proud to be your wife at last, dear, no matter what anyone may say about us," he heard. Woodford drew slowly back from the window. He paused in the darkness under the trees, his mind shaken, torn. So this was his homecoming from the tomb. This was the joy he had anticipated in Helen when he returned. It couldn't be the truth. His ears had deceived him. Helen could not be the wife of Curtis Dawes. Yet part of his mind told him remorselessly that it was true. He had always sensed that Helen's feeling for him was not as strong as his for her, but that she had loved Dawes he had never dreamed. Yet now he remembered Dawes's frequent visits, the odd silences between him and Helen. He remembered 1,000 trifles that spoke of the love which these two had cherished for each other. What was he, John Woodford, to do? Walk in upon them and tell them they had been premature in counting him dead, that he had come back to claim his position in life and his wife again? He couldn't do it. If Helen during those years had wavered in the least in her loyalty to him, he would have had less compunction. But in the face of those years of silent, uncomplaining life with him, he couldn't now reappear to her and blast her newfound happiness and blacken her name. Woodford laughed a little, bitterly. He was then to be an Enoch Arden from the tomb. A strange role, surely, yet it was the only one open to him. What was he to do? He couldn't let Helen know now that he was alive, couldn't return to the home that had been his. Yet he must go somewhere. Where? With a sudden leap of the heart, he thought of Jack, his son. He could at least go to Jack, let his son know that he was living. Jack, at least, would be overjoyed to see him, and would keep the fact of his return secret from his mother. John Woodford, with that thought rekindling a little his numbed feelings, started back through the trees toward the street. Where he had approached the house but minutes before with eager steps, he stole away now like a thief, fearful of being observed. He reached the street and started across the blocks toward the cottage of his son. Few were abroad, for the cold seemed increasing, and it was well past midnight. Woodford mechanically rubbed his stiffened hands as he hurried along. He came to his son's neat little white cottage and felt relief as he saw lights from its lower windows also. He had feared that no one would be up. He crossed the frozen lawn to the lighted windows, intent on seeing if Jack was there and if he was alone. He peered in, as he had done at his own home. Jack was sitting at a little desk, and his young wife was perched on the arm of his chair and was listening as he explained something to her from a sheet of writing on the desk. John Woodford, pressing his face against the cold windowpane, could hear Jack's words. "You see, Dorothy, we can just make it by adding our savings to Dad's insurance money," Jack was saying. "Oh, Jack," cried Dorothy happily, "and it's what you've wanted so long, a little business of your own." Jack nodded. "It won't be very big to start with, but I'll make it grow all right. This is the chance I've been hoping for, and I'm sure going to make the most of it." "Of course," he said, his face sobering a little, "it's too bad about Dad going like that. But seeing that he did die, the insurance money solves our problems of getting started. Now you take the overhead," he said, and began unreeling a string of figures to the intent Dorothy. John Woodford drew slowly back from the window. He felt more dazed and bewildered than ever. He had forgotten the insurance he had carried, which he had intended to give Jack his start, but of course, he saw now, it had been paid over when he was believed dead. He was not dead, but living. Yet if he let Jack know that, it meant the end of his son's long-desired opportunity. Jack would have to return the insurance money to the company, wrecking his dreamed-of chance. How could he let him know then? He, John Woodford, had already decided that he must remain dead to his wife, and therefore to the world. He might as well remain so to his son also. It was for the best. John Woodford melted away from the cottage into the darkness. When he reached the street, he stood in indecision. A freezing wind had begun to blow, and he felt very cold without an overcoat. Mechanically, he turned his coat collar closer around his neck. He tried to think what he must do. Neither Helen nor Jack must know that he was living, and that meant no one in the city must know. He must get out of the town to some other place, take up life under some other name. But he would need help and money to do that. Where was he to get them? Barred as he was from calling on his wife or son, to whom could he turn for help without letting his return become generally known? Howard Norse. The name came at once to Woodford's lips. Norse had been his employer, head of the firm where Woodford had held a position for many years. Woodford had been one of his oldest employees. Howard Norse would help him get to a position somewhere else and would keep his reappearance secret. He knew where Norse's residence was, several miles out in the country. But he couldn't walk that far, and he had no taxi or trolley fare. He would have to telephone Norse. Woodford walked back toward the city's central section, head bent against the piercing cold wind. He succeeded in finding an all-night lunchroom, whose proprietor allowed him to use the telephone. With cold, stiffened fingers, he dialed Norse's number. Howard Norse's sleepy voice soon came over the wire. "Mr. Norse, this is Woodford, John Woodford," he said quickly. There was an incredulous exclamation from Howard Norse. "You're crazy. John Woodford's been dead and buried for a couple of weeks." "No, I tell you it's John Woodford," insisted Woodford. "I'm not dead at all. I'm as living as you are. If you'll come into town for me, you'll see for yourself." "I'm not likely to drive to town at 2 a.m. to look at a maniac," Norse replied acidly. "Whatever your game is, you're wasting your time on me." "But you've got to help me," Woodford cried. "I've got to have money, a chance to get out of the city without anyone knowing. I gave your firm my services for years, and now you've got to give me help." "Listen to me, whoever you are," snapped Norse over the wire. "I was bothered long enough with John Woodford when he was living. He was so inefficient we'd have kicked him out long ago if we hadn't been sorry for him. But now that he's dead, you needn't think you can bother me in his name. Good night." The receiver clicked in Woodford's unbelieving ear. He stared at the instrument. So that was what they had really thought of him at the firm. There, where he had always thought himself one of the most highly valued of employees. But there must be someone upon whom he could call for help, someone he could convince that John Woodford was still living, someone who would be glad to think that he might be living. What about Willis Gran? Gran had been his closest friend next to Curtis Dawes. He had lent money more than once to Woodford in the past, and certainly should be willing to do so now. Hastily, Woodford called Grand's number. This time, he was more careful in his approach when he heard the other's voice. "Willis, I've got something to tell you that may sound incredible, but you've got to believe, do you hear?" he said. "Who is this, and what in the world are you talking about?" demanded Grand's startled voice. "Willis, this is John Woodford. Do you hear, John Woodford? Everyone thinks I'm dead, but I'm not, and I've got to see you." "What?" cried the other's voice over the telephone. "Why, you must be drunk. I saw Woodford lying in his coffin myself, so I know he's dead." "I tell you, it's not so. I'm not dead," Woodford almost screamed. "I've got to get some money, though, to get away from here, and you must lend it to me. You always lend it to me before, and I need it now worse than I ever did. I've got to get away." "So that's it," said Willis Gran. "Because I used to help Woodford out, you think you can get money from me just by calling me up and pretending that you're him. Why, Woodford himself was the biggest pest in the world with his constant borrowing. I felt almost relieved when he died. And now you try to make me believe that he's come back from the dead to pester me again." "But he never died. I'm John Woodford, really," Woodford protested vainly. "Sorry, old top," returned Grand's mocking voice. "Next time, pick a living person to impersonate, not a dead one." He hung up. John Woodford slowly replaced the receiver and made his way out into the street. The wind was blowing harder, and now was bringing with it clouds of fine snow that stung against his face like sand. He shivered as he stumbled along the streets of dark shops, his body freezing as his mind was frozen. There was no one from whom he could get help, he saw. His paramount necessity was still to get out of the city, and to do that he must rely on himself. The icy blasts of the snow-laden wind penetrated through his thin coat. His hands were shaking with the cold. A sign caught Woodford's eye, the illuminated beacon of a relief lodging house. At once he made his way toward it. He could at least sleep there tonight, get started from the city in the morning. The shabby men dozing inside in chairs looked queerly at him as he entered. So did the young clerk to whom he made his way. "I'd like to stay here tonight," he said to the clerk. The clerk stared. "Are you trying to kid me?" Woodford shook his head. "No, I'm penniless and it's cold outside. I've got to stay somewhere." The clerk smiled disdainfully. "Listen, fellow, no one with duds like yours is that hard up. Scram before I call a cop." Woodford looked down at his clothes, his frock coat and stiff white shirt and gleaming patent leather shoes, and he understood. He said desperately to the clerk, "But these clothes don't mean anything. I tell you, I haven't a penny." "Will you beat it before I have you thrown out of here?" the clerk demanded. Woodford backed toward the door. He went outside again into the cold. The wind had increased and more snow was falling. The front of Woodford's coat was soon covered with it as he pushed along. It came to him as a queer joke that the splendor of his funeral clothes should keep him from getting help now. He couldn't even beg a passerby for a dime. Who would give to a panhandler in formal clothes? Woodford felt his body quivering and his teeth chattering from sheer cold. If he could only get out of the blast of the icy wind. His eyes sought desperately along the street for a hallway where he might shelter himself. He found a deep doorway and crouched down inside it, out of the wind and driving snow. But hardly had he done so when a heavy step paused in front of him, and a nightstick rapped his feet smartly. An authoritative voice ordered him to get up and go home. Woodford did not try to explain to the policeman that he was not a drunken citizen fallen by the way. He got wearily to his feet and moved on along the street, unable to see more than a few feet ahead for the whirl of snow. The snow on which he was walking penetrated the thin shoes he wore, and his feet were soon even colder than the rest of his body. He walked with slow, dragging steps, head bent against the storm of white. He was dully aware that the dark shops beside him had given way to a low stone wall. With a sudden start, he recognized it as the wall of the cemetery, which he had left but hours before, the cemetery containing the vault from which he had escaped. The vault! Why hadn't he thought of it before, he asked himself. The vault would be a shelter from the freezing wind and snow. He could stay there for the night without anyone objecting. He paused, feeling for a moment a little renewal of his former terrors. Did he dare go back into that place from which he had struggled to escape? Then an extra strong blast of icy air struck him and decided him. The vault would be shelter, and that was what his frozen body craved more than anything else. Stiffly, he climbed over the low stone wall and made his way through the cemetery's whitened monuments and vaults toward the one from which he had escaped. The driving snow covered his tracks almost as he made them, as he trudged toward the vault. He reached it and tried its iron doors anxiously. Suppose he had locked them when he left. But to his relief, they swung open, and he entered and shut them. It was dark inside, but he was out of the wind and snow now, and his numbed body felt a little relief. Woodford sat down in the corner of the vault. It was a shelter for the night, at least. It seemed rather ironic that he had to come back here for shelter, but it was something to be thankful for that he even had this. In the morning, when the storm was over, he could leave without anyone seeing and get out of the city. He sat listening to the wind and snow shriek outside. The stone floor of the vault was very cold, so cold that he felt his limbs stiffening and cramping. And finally, he stood up unsteadily and paced to and fro in the vault, chafing his arms and hands. If he only had a blanket or even a heavy coat to lie upon, he'd freeze there upon the stone floor. Then as he turned in his pacing, he bumped into the coffin on the shelf, and a new idea was born in his mind. The coffin, why, the interior of it was lined deep with silk and satin padding. It would be warm in the coffin. He could sleep in it far better than on the cold stone floor. But did he dare to re-enter it? Again, Woodford felt faintly the former terrors he had experienced when he had awakened in it. But they meant nothing, he told himself. He would not be fastened in this time, and his frozen flesh yearned for the warmth of the coffin's lining. Slowly, carefully, he climbed up and lowered himself into the coffin and stretched out. The silken padding he sank into had a grateful warmth. He lowered his head upon the soft little pillow with a sigh of relief. This was better. He experienced an almost luxurious comfort now, but after he had lain for a little while, he felt that the top of his body was still cold, where the cold air came into the open coffin's top. That cold air entering kept him from being completely warm. If the lid above him were just closed to keep out the cold air. He reached up and got the edge of the heavy metal lid, then let it down upon himself. He was completely in the dark now, inside the closed coffin. But he was warm, too, for the lid kept out the cold air. And he was getting warmer all the time, as his body warmed up the interior. Yes, it was far more comfortable with the lid closed. An even warmth now pervaded his whole being, and the air inside the coffin was still getting warmer and thicker. He felt a little drowsy now as he breathed that warm air, felt luxuriously sleepy as he lay on the soft silk. It was getting a little harder to breathe somehow as the air became thicker. He ought really to raise the coffin lid and let in some fresh air, but it was so warm now and the air outside was so cold, and he was more and more sleepy. Something dim and receding in his fading consciousness told him that he was on the way to suffocation. But what if he was his sleepy thought. He was better off in here than back in the world outside. He had been a fool ever to fight so hard before to get out of this warm, comfortable coffin, to get back to that outside world. No, it was better like this, the darkness and the warmth and the sleep that advanced. Nobody would ever know that he had awakened at all, that he had been away from here at all. Everything would be just as before, just as before. And with that comforting assurance, John Woodford was swept farther and farther down the dark stream of unconsciousness, from which this time there would be no returning. I awoke abruptly from a horrible dream and stared wildly about. Then, seeing the high arched ceiling and the narrow stained windows of my friend's room, a flood of uneasy revelation coursed over me, and I knew that all of Andrew's hopes had been realized. I lay supine in a large bed, the posts of which reared upward in dizzy perspective, while on vast shelves about the chamber were the familiar books and antiques I was accustomed to seeing in that secluded corner of the crumbling and ancient mansion which had formed our joint home for many years. On a table by the wall stood a huge candelabrum of early workmanship and design, and the usual light window curtains had been replaced by hangings of somber black, which took on a faint ghostly luster in the dying light. I recalled forcibly the events preceding my confinement and seclusion in this veritable medieval fortress. They were not pleasant, and I shuddered anew when I remembered the couch that had held me before my tenancy of the present one, the couch that everyone supposed would be my last. Memory burned afresh regarding those hideous circumstances which had compelled me to choose between a true death and a hypothetical one, with a later reanimation by therapeutic methods known only to my comrade, Marshall Andrews. The whole thing had begun when I returned from the Orient a year before and discovered, to my utter horror, that I had contracted leprosy while abroad. I had known that I was taking grave chances in caring for my stricken brother in the Philippines, but no hint of my own affliction appeared until I returned to my native land. Andrews himself had made the discovery and kept it from me as long as possible, but our close acquaintance soon disclosed the awful truth. At once, I was quartered in our ancient abode atop the crags overlooking crumbling Hampton, from whose musty halls and quaint arched doorways I was never permitted to go forth. It was a terrible existence, with the yellow shadow hanging constantly over me, yet my friend never faltered in his faith, taking care not to contract the dread scourge, but meanwhile making life as pleasant and comfortable as possible. His widespread, though somewhat sinister, fame as a surgeon prevented any authority from discovering my plight and shipping me away. It was after nearly a year of this seclusion, late in August, that Andrews decided on a trip to the West Indies to study native medical methods, he said. I was left in care of Venerable Symes, the household factotum. So far, no outward signs of the disease had developed, and I enjoyed a tolerable, though almost completely private, existence during my colleague's absence. It was during this time that I read many of the tomes Andrews had acquired in the course of his 20 years as a surgeon, and learned why his reputation, though locally of the highest, was just a bit shady, for the volumes included any number of fanciful subjects hardly related to modern medical knowledge, treatises and unauthoritative articles on monstrous experiments and surgery, accounts of the bizarre effects of glandular transplantation and rejuvenation in animals and men alike, brochures on attempted brain transference, and a host of other fanatical speculations not countenanced by orthodox physicians. It appeared, too, that Andrews was an authority on obscure medicaments, some of the few books I waded through revealing that he had spent much time in chemistry and in the search for new drugs which might be used as aids in surgery. Looking back at those studies now, I find them hellishly suggestive when associated with his later experiments. Andrews was gone longer than I expected, returning early in November, almost 4 months later, and when he did arrive, I was quite anxious to see him, since my condition was at last on the brink of becoming noticeable. I had reached a point where I must seek absolute privacy to keep from being discovered. But my anxiety was slight as compared with his exuberance over a certain new plan he had hatched while in the Indies, a plan to be carried out with the aid of a curious drug he had learned of from a native doctor in Haiti. When he explained that his idea concerned me, I became somewhat alarmed, though in my position there could be little to make my plight worse. I had indeed considered more than once the oblivion that would come with a revolver or a plunge from the roof to the jagged rocks below. On the day after his arrival, in the seclusion of the dimly lit study, he outlined the whole grisly scheme. He had found in Haiti a drug, the formula for which he would develop later, which induced a state of profound sleep in anyone taking it, a trance so deep that death was closely counterfeited, with all muscular reflexes, even the respiration and heartbeat, completely stilled for the time being. Andrews had, he said, seen it demonstrated on natives many times. Some of them remained somnolent for days at a time, wholly immobile and as much like death as death itself. This suspended animation, he explained further, would even pass the closest examination of any medical man. He himself, according to all known laws, would have to report as dead a man under the influence of such a drug. He stated, too, that the subject's body assumed the precise appearance of a corpse, even a slight rigor mortis developing in prolonged cases. For some time, his purpose did not seem wholly clear, but when the full import of his words became apparent, I felt weak and nauseated. Yet in another way I was relieved, for the thing meant at least partial escape from my curse, an escape from the banishment and shame of an ordinary death of the dread leprosy. Briefly, his plan was to administer a strong dose of the drug to me and call the local authorities, who would immediately pronounce me dead and see that I was buried within a very short while. He felt assured that with their careless examination, they would fail to notice my leprosy symptoms, which in truth had hardly appeared. Only a trifle over 15 months had passed since I had caught the disease, whereas the corruption takes 7 years to run its entire course. Later, he said, would come resurrection. After my interment in the family graveyard, beside my century dwelling and barely a quarter mile from his own ancient pile, the appropriate steps would be taken. Finally, when my estate was settled and my decease widely known, he would secretly open the tomb and bring me to his own abode again, still alive and none the worse for my adventure. It seemed a ghastly and daring plan, but to me it offered the only hope for even a partial freedom, so I accepted his proposition, but not without a myriad of misgivings. What if the effect of the drug should wear off while I was in my tomb? What if the coroner should discover the awful ruse and fail to inter me? These were some of the hideous doubts which assailed me before the experiment. Though death would have been a release from my curse, I feared it even worse than the yellow scourge, feared it even when I could see its black wings constantly hovering over me. Fortunately, I was spared the horror of viewing my own funeral and burial rites. They must, however, have gone just as Andrews had planned, even to the subsequent disinterment, for after the initial dose of the poison from Haiti, I lapsed into a semi-paralytic state, and from that to a profound night-black sleep. The drug had been administered in my room, and Andrews had told me before giving it that he would recommend to the coroner a verdict of heart failure due to nerve strain. Of course, there was no embalming, Andrews saw to that, and the whole procedure, leading up to my secret transportation from the graveyard to his crumbling manor, covered a period of 3 days. Having been buried late in the afternoon of the third day, my body was secured by Andrews that very night. He had replaced the fresh sod just as it had been when the workmen left. Old Symes, sworn to secrecy, had helped Andrews in his ghoulish task. Later, I had lain for over a week in my old familiar bed. Owing to some unexpected effect of the drug, my whole body was completely paralyzed, so that I could move my head only slightly. All my senses, however, were fully alert, and by another week's time I was able to take nourishment in good quantities. Andrews explained that he had revived my upper half first, and could not account for the complete bodily paralysis, though my condition seemed to trouble him little, considering the damnably intent interest he centered upon my reactions and stimuli from the very beginning. Many times during lulls in our conversation, I would catch a strange gleam in his eyes as he viewed me on the couch, a glint of victorious exultation which, queerly enough, he never voiced aloud, though he seemed to be quite glad that I had run the gauntlet of death and had come through alive. Still, there was that horror I was to meet in less than 6 years, which added to my desolation and melancholy during the tedious days in which I awaited the return of normal bodily functions. But I would be up and about, he assured me, before very long, enjoying an existence few men had ever experienced. The words did not, however, impress me with their true and ghastly meaning until many days later. During that awful siege in bed, Andrews and I became somewhat estranged. He no longer treated me so much like a friend as like an implement in his skilled and greedy fingers. I found him possessed of unexpected traits, little examples of baseness and cruelty, apparent even to the hardened Symes, which disturbed me in a most unusual manner. Often he would display extraordinary cruelty to live specimens in his laboratory, for he was constantly carrying on various hidden projects in glandular and muscular transplantation on guinea pigs and rabbits. He had also been employing his newly discovered sleeping potion in curious experiments with suspended animation. But of these things he told me very little, though old Symes often let slip chance comments which shed some light on the proceedings. I was not certain how much the old servant knew, but he had surely learned a considerable amount, being a constant companion to both Andrews and myself. With the passage of time, a slow but consistent feeling began creeping into my disabled body, and at the reviving symptoms, Andrews took a fanatical interest in my case. He still seemed more coldly analytical than sympathetic toward me, taking my pulse and heartbeat with more than usual zeal. Occasionally, in his fevered examinations, I saw his hands tremble slightly, an uncommon sight with so skilled a surgeon, but he seemed oblivious of my scrutiny. I was never allowed even a momentary glimpse of my full body, but with the feeble return of the sense of touch, I was aware of a bulk and heaviness which at first seemed awkward and unfamiliar. Gradually, I regained the use of my hands and arms, and with the passing of the paralysis came a new and terrible sensation of physical estrangement. My limbs had difficulty in following the commands of my mind, and every movement was jerky and uncertain. So clumsy were my hands that I had to become accustomed to them all over again. This must, I thought, be due to my disease and the advance of the contagion in my system. Being unaware of how the early symptoms affected the victim, my brother's being a more advanced case, I had no means of judging, and since Andrews shunned the subject, I deemed it better to remain silent. One day I asked Andrews, I no longer considered him a friend, if I might try rising and sitting up in bed. At first, he objected strenuously, but later, after cautioning me to keep the blankets well up around my chin so that I would not be chilled, he permitted it. This seemed strange in view of the comfortable temperature. Now that late autumn was slowly turning into winter, the room was always well heated. A growing chilliness at night and occasional glimpses of a leaden sky through the window had told me of the changing season, for no calendar was ever in sight upon the dingy walls. With the gentle help of Symes, I was eased to a sitting position, Andrews coldly watching from the door of the laboratory. At my success, a slow smile spread across his leering features, and he turned to disappear from the darkened doorway. His mood did nothing to improve my condition. Old Symes, usually so regular and consistent, was now often late in his duties, sometimes leaving me alone for hours at a time. The terrible sense of alienation was heightened by my new position. It seemed that the legs and arms inside my gown were hardly able to follow the summoning of my mind, and it became mentally exhausting to continue movement for any length of time. My fingers, woefully clumsy, were wholly unfamiliar to my inner sense of touch, and I wondered vaguely if I were to be accursed the rest of my days with an awkwardness induced by my dread malady. It was on the evening following my half-recovery that the dreams began. I was tormented not only at night but during the day as well. I would awaken screaming horribly from some frightful nightmare I dared not think about outside the realm of sleep. These dreams consisted mainly of ghoulish things, graveyards at night, stalking corpses, and lost souls amid a chaos of blinding light and shadow. The terrible reality of the visions disturbed me most of all. It seemed that some inside influence was inducing the grisly vistas of moonlit tombstones and endless catacombs of the restless dead. I could not place their source, and at the end of the week I was quite frantic with abominable thoughts which seemed to obtrude themselves upon my unwelcome consciousness. By that time, a slow plan was forming, whereby I might escape the living hell into which I had been propelled. Andrews cared less and less about me, seeming intent only on my progress and growth and recovery of normal muscular reactions. I was becoming every day more convinced of the nefarious doings going on in that laboratory across the threshold. The animal cries were shocking and rasped hideously on my overwrought nerves. And I was gradually beginning to think that Andrews had not saved me from deportation solely for my own benefit, but for some accursed reason of his own. Symes' attention was slowly becoming slighter and slighter, and I was convinced that the aged servitor had a hand in the deviltry somewhere. Andrews no longer eyed me as a friend, but as an object of experimentation, nor did I like the way he fingered his scalpel when he stood in the narrow doorway and stared at me with crafty alertness. I had never before seen such a transformation come over any man. His ordinarily handsome features were now lined and whisker-grown, and his eyes gleamed as if some imp of Satan were staring from them. His cold, calculating gaze made me shudder horribly and gave me a fresh determination to free myself from his bondage as soon as possible. I had lost track of time during my dream orgy and had no way of knowing how fast the days were passing. The curtains were often drawn in the daytime, the room being lit by waxen cylinders in the large candelabrum. It was a nightmare of living horror and unreality, though through it all I was gradually becoming stronger. I always gave careful responses to Andrew's inquiries concerning my returning physical control, concealing the fact that a new life was vibrating through me with every passing day, an altogether strange sort of strength, but one which I was counting on to serve me in the coming crisis. Finally, one chilly evening when the candles had been extinguished and a pale shaft of moonlight fell through the dark curtains upon my bed, I determined to rise and carry out my plan of action. There had been no movement from either of my captors for several hours, and I was confident that both were asleep in adjoining bedchambers. Shifting my cumbersome weight carefully, I rose to a sitting position and crawled cautiously out of bed, down upon the floor. A vertigo gripped me momentarily, and a wave of weakness flooded my entire being. But finally, strength returned, and by clutching at a bedpost, I was able to stand upon my feet for the first time in many months. Gradually, a new strength coursed through me, and I donned the dark robe which I had seen hanging on a nearby chair. It was quite long, but served as a cloak over my nightdress. Again came that feeling of awful unfamiliarity which I had experienced in bed, that sense of alienation and of difficulty in making my limbs perform as they should. But there was need for haste before my feeble strength might give out. As a last precaution in dressing, I slipped some old shoes over my feet, but though I could have sworn they were my own, they seemed abnormally loose, so that I decided they must belong to the aged Symes. Seeing no other heavy objects in the room, I seized from the table the huge candelabrum, upon which the moon shone with a pallid glow, and proceeded very quietly toward the laboratory door. My first steps came jerkily and with much difficulty, and in the semi-darkness I was unable to make my way very rapidly. When I reached the threshold, a glance within revealed my former friend, seated in a large overstuffed chair, while beside him was a smoking stand, upon which were assorted bottles and a glass. He reclined halfway in the moonlight through the large window, and his greasy features were creased in a drunken smirk. An open book lay in his lap, one of the hideous tomes from his private library. For a long moment, I gloated over the prospect before me, and then, stepping forward suddenly, I brought the heavy weapon down upon his unprotected head. The dull crunch was followed by a spurt of blood, and the fiend crumpled to the floor, his head laid half open. I felt no contrition at taking the man's life in such a manner. In the hideous, half-visible specimens of his surgical wizardry scattered around the room, in various stages of completion and preservation, I felt there was enough evidence to blast his soul without my aid. Andrews had gone too far in his practices to continue living, and as one of his monstrous specimens, of that I was now hideously certain, it was my duty to exterminate him. Symes, I realized, would be no such easy matter. Indeed, only unusual good fortune had caused me to find Andrews unconscious. When I finally reeled up to the servant's bedchamber door, faint from exhaustion, I knew it would take all my remaining strength to complete the ordeal. The old man's room was in utmost darkness, being on the north side of the structure, but he must have seen me silhouetted in the doorway as I came in. He screamed hoarsely, and I aimed the candelabrum at him from the threshold. It struck something soft, making a sloughing sound in the darkness, but the screaming continued. From that time on, events became hazy and jumbled together, but I remember grappling with the man and choking the life from him little by little. He gibbered a host of awful things before I could lay hands on him, cried and begged for mercy from my clutching fingers. I hardly realized my own strength in that mad moment, which left Andrew's associate in a condition like his own. Retreating from the darkened chamber, I stumbled for the stairway door, sagged through it, and somehow reached the landing below. No lamps were burning, and my only light was a filtering of moonbeams coming from the narrow windows in the hall, but I made my jerky way over the cold, damp slabs of stone, reeling from the terrible weakness of my exertion, and reached the front door after ages of fumbling and crawling about in the darkness. Vague memories and haunting shadows came to taunt me in that ancient hallway, shadows once friendly and understandable, but now grown alien and unrecognizable, so that I stumbled down the worn steps in a frenzy of something more than fear. For a moment I stood in the shadow of the giant stone manor, viewing the moonlit trail down which I must go to reach the home of my forefathers, only a quarter of a mile distant. But the way seemed long, and for a while I despaired of ever traversing the whole of it. At last I grasped a piece of dead wood as a cane and set out down the winding road. Ahead, seemingly only a few rods away in the moonlight, stood the venerable mansion where my ancestors had lived and died. Its turrets rose spectrally in the shimmering radiance, and the black shadow cast on the beetling hillside appeared to shift and waver, as if belonging to a castle of unreal substance. There stood the monument of half a century, a haven for all my family, old and young, which I had deserted many years ago to live with the fanatical Andrews. It stood empty on that fateful night, and I hope that it may always remain so. In some manner, I reached the aged place, though I do not remember the last half of the journey at all. It was enough to be near the family cemetery, among whose moss-covered and crumbling stones I would seek the oblivion I had desired. As I approached the moonlit spot, the old familiarity, so absent during my abnormal existence, returned to plague me in a wholly unexpected way. I drew close to my own tombstone, and the feeling of homecoming grew stronger. With it came a fresh flood of that awful sense of alienation and disembodiment which I knew so well. I was satisfied that the end was drawing near, nor did I stop to analyze emotions till a little later, when the full horror of my position burst upon me. Intuitively, I knew my own tombstone, for the grass had scarcely begun to grow between the pieces of sod. With feverish haste, I began clawing at the mound and scraping the wet earth from the hole left by the removal of the grass and roots. How long I worked in the nitrous soil before my fingers struck the coffin lid, I can never say, but sweat was pouring from me, and my nails were but useless bleeding hooks. At last, I threw out the last bit of loose earth, and with trembling fingers tugged on the heavy lid. It gave a trifle, and I was prepared to lift it completely open, when a fetid and nauseous odor assailed my nostrils. I started erect, horrified. Had some idiot placed my tombstone on the wrong grave, causing me to unearth another body? For surely there could be no mistaking that awful stench. Gradually a hideous uncertainty came over me, and I scrambled from the hole. One look at the newly made headpiece was enough. This was indeed my own grave, but what fool had buried within it another corpse? All at once, a bit of the unspeakable truth propelled itself upon my brain. The odor, in spite of its putrescence, seemed somehow familiar, horribly familiar. Yet I could not credit my senses with such an idea. Reeling and cursing, I fell into the black cavity once more, and by the aid of a hastily lit match, lifted the long lid completely open. Then the light went out, as if extinguished by a malignant hand, and I clawed my way out of that accursed pit, screaming in a frenzy of fear and loathing. When I regained consciousness, I was lying before the door of my own ancient manor, where I must have crawled after that hideous rendezvous in the family cemetery. I realized that dawn was close at hand, and rose feebly, opening the aged portal before me and entering the place which had known no footsteps for over a decade. A fever was ravaging my weakened body, so that I was hardly able to stand, but I made my way slowly through the musty, dimly lit chambers, and staggered into my own study, the study I had deserted so many years before. When the sun has risen, I shall go to the ancient well beneath the old willow tree by the cemetery, and cast my deformed self into it. No other man shall ever view this blasphemy which has survived life longer than it should have. I do not know what people will say when they see my disordered grave, but this will not trouble me if I can find oblivion from that which I beheld amidst the crumbling, moss-crusted stones of the hideous place. I now know why Andrews was so secretive in his actions, so damnably gloating in his attitude toward me after my artificial death. He had meant me for a specimen all the time, a specimen of his greatest feat of surgery, his masterpiece of unclean witchery, an example of perverted artistry for him alone to see. Where Andrews obtained that other, with which I lay accursed in his moldering mansion, I shall probably never know, but I am afraid that it was brought from Haiti along with his fiendish medicine. At least these long hairy arms and horrible short legs are alien to me, alien to all natural and sane laws of mankind. The thought that I shall be tortured with that other during the rest of my brief existence is another hell. Now I can but wish for that which once was mine, that which every man blessed of God ought to have at death, that which I saw in that awful moment in the ancient burial ground when I raised the lid on my coffin, my own shrunken, decayed, and headless body.